Joe Fernwright, on the short trip, continued to examine the untitled book. It preoccupied him, preempting the colorful shops which the taxi passed, and the several life forms bustling about here and there. He was aware of the city street, its people, and buildings, but only dimly, because he had already found another passage in English. Obviously, the undertaking involves the locating of and the raising and repair of an underwater structure, probably, due to the number of engineers involved, of great magnitude. Almost certainly an entire city or even an entire civilization, very likely of some remote past age. And then, once again, the text lapsed into a foreign script resembling dots and dashes, a sort of binary system of annotation. Joe said to the girl beside him in the taxi, "The people who are writing this book know about the raising of Helbskala." "Yes," Molly said shortly. "But where's the precognition?" Joe demanded. "This is remarkably up to date, right up to this minute, give or take an hour, but that's all." "You will find it," Molly said, "when you have looked a long time. It is buried, among the different texts, which are all translations of one primary text, one line like a thread, the thread of the past entering the present, then entering the future. Somewhere in that book, Mr. Fernwright, the future of Helbskala is written, the future of Glimmung, the future of us. We are all woven in by the yarn of the Kalends' time, their time outside of time." Joe said, "And you already knew about this book, before the Spittle sold it to you?" "I saw it before, when Ralph and I were here. The SSA machine extrapolated we'd be joyous, and the Kalends book, this book, said Ralph would..." She paused. "He killed himself. First he tried to kill me, but he wasn't able to."
"And the Kalends book said that?"
"Yes, exactly that. I remember it, Ralph and I reading in the text about ourselves and not believing, still under the idea that the SSA mechanism was scientific data analysis, and this book was tale by old wife, a lot of old wives, seeing doom when we and the SSA machine saw happyhood."
"Why did the SSA machine miss?"
"It missed because it didn't have one datum. Whitney's syndrome, psychotic reaction to amphetamines by Ralph, paranoia and murderous hostility. He thought himself overweight. He took them as..."
She hunted for the word.
"Appetite suppressants," Joe said. "Like alcohol."
"Good for some people," he thought. "Lethal for others.
And Whitney's syndrome didn't require overdoses. Even a small amount triggered it off. If the latent illness was already there. Just as, for an alcoholic, the smallest drink meant defeat and bitter, utter, final destruction."
"Too bad," he murmured.
The taxi pulled up to the curb. Its driver, a beaver-like creature with wicked cutting teeth, said several words in a language which Joe did not understand. Molly, however, nodded and gave the beaverish individual a sum of metal money from her purse. And then she and Joe stepped from the taxi onto the sidewalk. Joe, looking around him, said, "It's like going back 150 years. Surface cars, carbon arc lighting. This could be Earth in the days of President Franklin Roosevelt," he thought to himself, both enticed and amused. He liked it. The pace, he realized, it's slower, and the density of population, relatively few organisms propelled themselves up and down the street, either on foot, or a reasonable substitute, or in cars.
"You can see why I got angry at you," Molly said, catching his reaction. "For your defaming Plowman's planet, my home for 6 years. And now," she gestured, "I'm back, and doing again what I did then, believing faith in an SSA mechanism."
"Let's go inside the hotel," Joe said, "and have a drink." Together they passed through the revolving door into the Olympia Hotel, with its wooden floors, carved hardwood decorations, polished brass doorknobs and railings, and thick red carpet. And its antique elevator, which Joe had already caught sight of. Non-automatic, he discovered. The elevator required an attendant. In his hotel room, with its dresser, splotched mirror, iron bed, and canvas window shade elegance, Joe Fernwright sat on an overstuffed faded chair and studied the book. Not long ago he had been preoccupied with the game, and now the book. But this consisted of something quite different, and the more he read of the book, the more he realized it. Gradually, as he nosed among its pages, he began to assemble in his mind the totality of the English text.
He had begun to put the separate bits in superimposition over one another.
"I'm going to take a bath," Molly said. She had already opened her suitcase and had laid most of her clothes out on the bed in her room.
"Isn't it strange, Joe Fernwright," she called, "that we have to keep two rooms, like a century ago?"
"Yes," he said.
She entered the room, wearing only her tight pants. Bare from the waist up, he saw. Small-breasted but dense and tall, with fine muscle tone. The body of a dancer, he said to himself. Or a Cro-Magnon female, a hunter, an astute, supple person accustomed to long, lean, even fruitless marches. There was not a gram of useless flesh on her, as he had already discovered in the locked lounge of the ship. He had clutched it then, now he saw it. However, he thought morbidly, Kate had, actually still has, as good a figure. That made him depressed. He returned to reading the book.
"Would you have wanted to sleep with me," Molly said, "if I were a cyclops?"
She pointed to a spot above her nose.
"One eye there, Polyphemus, the cyclops in the Odyssey. They put his one eye out with a burning stick, I think."
Joe said, "Listen to this." He read aloud from the book. "The current dominant species on the planet consists of what is called a glimmung. This shadowy, enormous entity is not native to the planet. It migrated here several centuries ago, taking over from the weak species left over when the once ruling master species, the so-called fog things of antiquity, vanished." Joe waved her to come and look. "Glimmung's power, however, is sharply curtailed by a mysterious book in which it is alleged everything which has been, is, and will be, is recorded." He snapped the book shut. "It's talking about itself." Coming over to his chair, Molly bent to read the text.
"Let me see what else it says," she said.
"That's all. The English part ended there." Taking the book from him, Molly began to glance through it. She had begun to frown. Her face was tense and stern.
"Well, here you are, Joe," she said at last. "As I told you, you're in here by name."
He took the book from her and read rapidly. "Joseph Fernwright learns that Glimmung considers the Kallens and their book his antagonist, and is said to be plotting to undermine the Kallens once and for all. How he will do this, though, is not known. Here the rumors begin to differ."
"Let me turn the pages," Molly said.
She examined the subsequent pages and then, her face darkening, paused.
"In my language," she said.
For a long, long time she studied the passage, and as she read and reread it, her expression became more intense, shadowed by her own intense urgency into starkness.
"It says," she said at last, "that Glimmung's undertaking is the raising of the cathedral-held Scala to dry land once more, and that he will fail."
"Is there more?" Joe said. He had a feeling there was. Her face showed it. Molly said,
"It says that most of those recruited to help Glimmung will be destroyed when the undertaking fails."
She corrected herself.
"To Ujik. Damaged or made to unexist. Maimed, that's it. They will be permanently altered beyond immediate repair."
"Do you think Glimmung knows about these passages?" Joe said. "That he'll fail and will be..."
"Of course he knows. It's there in the text in that section you read. Glimmung considers the Kallens in their book his antagonist and plots to undermine them. And he's raising Held Scala to undermine them."
"It didn't say that," Joe said. "It reads, how he will do this, though, is not known. Here the rumors begin to differ."
"But obviously it's the raising of Held Scala."
She paced about the room in agitation, her hands clasped tightly together.
"You said it yourself. The people who are writing this book know about the raising of Held Scala. All you have to do is put the two passages together. I told you it was all there. Our future, Held Scala's, Glimmung's. And ours is to unexist. To die."
She halted, stared at him frantically.
"That's the way the fog things perished. They challenged the book of the Kallens. As the Spittles can tell you, the Spittles are still chattering about it."
Joe said, "We'd better tell the rest of the people here at the hotel about it." A knock sounded on the door. It opened, and Harper Baldwin peered apologetically into the room. "I'm sorry to bother the two of you," he rumbled, "but we've been reading this book." He held up his copy of the Book of the Kallens. "There's stuff in it about all of us. I'm having the hotel management notify all its guests to meet in the main conference room in half an hour." We'll be there, Joe said. And beside him, Maliyoyez nodded, her partially disclosed body rigid with concern. Chapter 8. Half an hour later, all of them, a hotel full of sentient organisms of 40 kinds, filled the main conference room. Joe, looking about at the enormous variety of life forms, saw, among them, several which he had eaten back on Earth. Most of the forms he did not recognize. Glimmung had, in fact, gone to many star systems to get the talent he wanted, more than Joe had realized. "I think," Joe said quietly to Molly, "that we ought to prepare ourselves for a full manifestation of Glimmung. He'll probably show up here as he really is." Molly grated, "He weighs 40,000 tons. If he manifested himself here as he really is, he'd collapse the building. He'd fall through the floor and down to the basement." "Then in some other form, such as that of a bird." On the stage, at the microphone, Harper Baldwin rapped for silence. "Come on, folks," he said. And in all that vast variety of tongues needed, his words were translated into each earphone.
"You mean such as a chicken?" Molly said.
Joe said, "That's not a bird. A chicken is fowl, barnyard fowl. I mean like a soaring great long-winged albatross."
"Glimmung isn't above lowly things," Molly said. "Once he manifested himself to me..."
She broke off.
"Never mind."
"What this meeting is about, folks," Harper Baldwin continued, "has to do with a book they have here that we've run across. Now, those of you who've been on this planet longer probably know about it. If so, you've already formed your own..."
A multi-legged gastropod rose up and spoke into its microphone.
"Of course we are familiar with the book. The Spittle sell it at the spaceport."
Molly said into her own mic,
"Our edition, being later than yours, may contain material you haven't read."
"We buy a new edition each day," the gastropod said.
"Then you know it says that the raising of Held Scala will fail," Joe said, "and that we'll be killed."
"It does not precisely say that," the gastropod answered. "It says that those he employs will suffer, will receive some sort of blow which will permanently change them."
An immense dragonfly took the floor by the simple expedient of flying up to Harper Baldwin's entrenchment and landing on his shoulder. Challenging the gastropod, it said,
"There is no doubt, however, that the Book of the Kalans predicts the failure of the attempt to raise Held Scala."
The gastropod yielded the floor to a reddish jelly supported by a metal frame that held it upright. Hence, it could join in the discussion. As it spoke, it flushed darkly, obviously very shy.
"The burden of the text seems to state that the raising of the cathedral will fail. Seems to state, I put it to you. I am a linguist, brought here by Mr. Glimmung for that reason. Under the water in the cathedral, there are countless documents. The key sentence, 'the undertaking will fail,' appears 123 times in the book. I have read each of the translations, and I submit that the text most properly means, there will be failure after the undertaking, that it will lead to failure, rather than it will fail."
"I don't see the difference," Harper Baldwin said, frowning. "Anyhow, the part that's important for us is the part about our being killed or injured, not the failure of the undertaking. Isn't this book always right? The creature that sold it to me said it was."
The reddish jelly said,
"The creature who sold that book gets 40% of the purchase price for itself. Naturally, it says the book is accurate."
Stung by the jibe, Joe hopped to his feet.
"Then, by the same token, you could indict all the doctors in the universe on the grounds that they make money when you're sick, so they're responsible for your being sick when you're sick."
Laughing, Molly tugged him back down onto his seat.
"Oh, God," she said, covering her mouth. "I don't think anyone's defended the Spittles in 200 years. Now they have a champagne."
"Champion," Joe growled, still feeling the heat of resentment. "It's our lives," he said to her, "that we're talking about. This isn't a political debate or a taxpayers' meeting about the local transportation." An undercurrent of muttering moved about the room. The craftsmen and scientists were talking among themselves.
"I move," Harper Baldwin brayed, "that we act collectively, that we form a permanent organization with officers who can deal as a deputation with Glimmung for the rights of us all. But before that, all of you friends and co-workers seated here today, or flying around the room here today, I suggest that we take an initial vote as to whether we want to work on the undertaking at all. Maybe we don't want to. Maybe we want to go home. Maybe we ought to go home. Let's see how we feel collectively about it. Now, how many vote to go ahead and work? He broke off. A vast rumbling shook the conference room. Harper Baldwin's voice had become inaudible. Talk for any of them was now out of the question. Glimmung had come. It must be the true manifestation, Joe decided as he watched and listened. It was in all respects the real Glimmung, Glimmung as he actually was, and so, like the sound of 10,000 junked, rusty automobiles being stirred by one giant wooden spoon, Glimmung heaved himself up and onto the raised stage at the far end of the conference room. His body quivered and shuddered, and from deep inside him a moan became audible. The moan grew, rose, until it became a shriek. An animal, Joe thought. Caught, perhaps in a trap. One paw. And it's trying to get loose, but the trap is too complicated. And at the same time, a great spewing forth of brackish seawater, trash fish, aquatic mammals, sea kelp. The room reeked with the roar and shock of the sea. And in the center of it all, the churning lump which was Glimmung. The hotel people aren't going to like this, Joe said half aloud. Good God! The huge mass of fluttering extremities, the whipping, writhing arms which flung themselves at every spot on the gigantic carcass. The whole thing heaved, and then with a furious roar it collapsed the floor beneath it. The mass disappeared from sight, leaving remnants of the sea all over the room. From the gaping chasm, smoke-like tendrils, probably steam, fizzled upward. But Glimmung was gone. As Molly had predicted, his weight had been too great. Glimmung was down in the basement of the hotel, 10 floors below them. Shaken, Harper Baldwin said into his microphone, Apparently, we'll have to go downstairs to talk to him. Several life forms hurried over to him. He listened, then straightened up and said, I understand he's in the cellar rather than on the next floor. Baldwin gestured in agitation. Evidently, went the whole way down.
I knew it would happen, Molly said. If he tried to come here, well, we'll have to conduct our words with him in the cellar.
She and Joe both got to their feet. They joined the crowd of life forms gathered at the elevators. Joe said, he should have come as an albatross. Chapter 9. When they reached the basement, Glimmung boomed a hearty greeting at them. You don't need translating equipment, he informed them. I'll speak to each of you telepathically in your own language. He filled almost all of the basement. They had to remain by the elevators. Now he had become more dense, more compact, but he still remained huge. Joe took a large, deep, steadying breath and said, Are you going to pay the hotel compensation for the damage you've done?
My check, Glimmung said, will be in the mail by tomorrow morning.
Mr. Fernwright just meant that as a joke, Harper Baldwin said nervously, about paying the hotel. Joke, Joe said. Collapsing 10 floors of a 12-floor building? How do you know people weren't killed? There could be as many as 100 dead, plus a lot more injured.
No, Glimmung assured him. I killed no one. But the query is legitimate, Mr. Fernwright.
Joe felt the presence of Glimmung within him, stirring in his brain. Glimmung edged here and there throughout the most unusual corners of Joe's mind. I wonder what he's looking for, Joe thought. And at once the answer within his consciousness came.
I'm interested in your reaction to the Book of the Kalends, Glimmung said.
He spoke then to all of them.
Out of all of you, only Miss Yoyez knew about the book. The rest of you I'll need to study. It will only take a moment.
The extension of Glimmung left Joe's mind then. It had gone elsewhere. Turning to Joe, Molly said,
I'm going to ask him a question.
She, too, took a deep and steadying breath.
Glimmung, she said sharply, tell me one thing. Are you going to die soon?
The enormous lump throbbed, its whip-like extremities thrashed in agitation.
Does it say that in the Book of the Kalends? Glimmung demanded.
It does not. If I were, it would say.
Molly said, then the book is infallible.
You have no reason to think I am near death, Glimmung said.
None at all, Molly said. I asked my question in order to learn something. I learned it.
When I am depressed, Glimmung said, I begin to think about the Book of the Kalends, and I think that their prediction that I cannot raise Heldskalla is true. That in fact I can accomplish nothing. The cathedral will remain at the bottom of Mare Nostrum into eternity. Joe said, But that's when your energy is low. Each living entity, Glimmung said, passes through periods of expansion and periods of contraction. The rhythm of living is as active in me as is any of you. I am larger, I am older. I can do many things that none of you even collectively can. But there are times when the sun is low in the sky, toward evening, before true night. Small lights come on here and there, but they are a long way off from me. Where I dwell, there are no lights. I could, of course, manufacture life, light, and activity around me, but they would be extensions of myself alone. This, of course, is changed, now that you have begun to come here. The group today is the final group. Miss Molly Yoyes and Mr. Fernwright and Mr. Baldwin, and those with them, are the last who will be coming. I wonder, Joe thought, if we will leave this planet again. He thought about Earth and his life there. He thought about the game and his room with its dead black window. He thought about the government's Mickey Mouse money that came in baskets. He thought of Kate. I won't be calling her again, he thought. For some reason I know that. It is a fact. Probably because of Molly. Or, perhaps, he thought, the larger situation. Glimmung and the undertaking. And Glimmung's falling through the floor, he thought, descending 10 stories and winding up in the basement. That meant something, he realized. And then he realized something else. Glimmung knew his weight. As Molly had said, no floor could hold him. Glimmung had done it on purpose. So we wouldn't be afraid of him, Joe realized, when we at last saw him as he really is. Then, he thought, we really should be afraid of him, perhaps, more so than before, just exactly because of this. Afraid of me? Glimmung's thought came. Of the whole undertaking, Joe said. There's too little chance of it being a success. You're right, Glimmung said. We're talking about chances, about possibilities, statistical probabilities. It may work, it may not. I don't claim to know. I'm only hoping. I have no certitude about the future. Nor does anyone else, including the Kalends. That is the basis of my entire position, and my intent. Joe said, But to try, and then to fail, is that so terrible? Glimmung said. I'll now tell you something about yourselves, something that every one of you possesses, a quality in common. You have met failure so often that you have all become afraid to fail. I thought so, Joe thought. Well, so it goes. What I am doing, Glimmung said, is this. I am attempting to learn how much strength I have. There is no abstract way of determining the limits of one's force, one's ability to exert effort. It can only be measured in a way such as this. A task which brings into view the actual real limitation to my admittedly finite but great strength. Failure will tell me as much about myself as will success. Do you see that? No, none of you can. You're paralyzed. That's why I brought you here. Self-knowledge, that is what I will achieve. And so will you, each about himself. Suppose we fail, Molly asked. The self-knowledge will be there anyhow, Glimmung said. He sounded baffled, as if there was a gap between himself and the group of them. You really do not understand, do you? He said to them all. You will before it's over. Those of you, anyhow, who want to go through with it. A fungiform lispingly asked, At this late point, do we still have the right to choose? Any of you who wish to return to your own world are free to do so, Glimmung said. I will provide passage, first class, back. But those of you who do go back, you will find it once again as it was. And as it was, you could not live such a life. Each of you intended to destroy yourselves and were in the process of so doing when I found you. Remember, that is what lies behind you. Don't make it that which lies ahead of you. There was an uncomfortable silence. I'm leaving, Harper Baldwin said. Several others moved closer to him, signifying that they would leave too. What about you? Molly asked Joe. Joe said, What's behind me is the police. And death, he thought, the same as for you, for us all. No, he said. I'm going to try. I'll take the chance that we fail. Maybe he's right. Maybe even failure is valuable. As he says, it tells us the limit of ourselves. It maps our boundaries.
If you'll give me a tobacco cigarette, Molly said with a shiver of fear, I'll stay too, but I'm dying for a cigarette.
That's nothing worth dying for, Joe said. Let's die for this, even if we fall 10 stories into the basement doing it.
And the rest of you are staying, Glimmong said.
That's right,
a univalvular cephalopod squeaked. Uneasily, Harper Baldwin said, I'll stay, I guess.
Glimmong, with satisfaction, said, Then let us begin.
At the curb before the Olympia Hotel, heavy-duty trucks had been parked. Each had a driver, and each driver knew what to do. A portly organism with a long, ropey tail approached Joe and Molly, a clipboard clutched energetically in its fuzzy paw.
You two are to go with me,
the organism declared, and then picked up from the group 11 more individuals.
That's a wourge, Molly said to Joe. Our driver. They can make excellent speed. Their reflexes are so acute. We'll be out on the promontory in the manner of a minute.
Matter of minutes, Joe corrected absently, as he seated himself on the bench in the rear segment of the truck. Other life forms squeezed in with Joe and Molly, and then the truck engine came noisily to life.
What kind of turbine is that? Joe said, annoyed by the noise it made.
A kindly-looking bivalve beside him groaned,
It's internal combustion. Bang, 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 all the way.
The frontier, Joe said, and felt an aching joy all at once. Yes, he thought, this is the frontier. We are back with Abraham Lincoln in a log cabin, and Daniel Boone, all of them, the old-time pioneers. One by one, the trucks pulled away from the curb, their lights yellow in the night, like the orbs of luminous foreign moths.
Glimmong will be waiting for us, Molly said. When we get there.
She sounded tired.
He's capable of reflex relocation, based on automatic pulsations emanating from within his own neurological substructure. For all intents and purposes, he can move from one locus to another without time lapse.
She rubbed her eyes and sighed. The helpful bivalve spoke up once more.
The creature beside you, Mr. Fernwright, is truthful.
It extended a pseudo-podium to Molly.
Monsieur Yez, I am Nurbkoldak from Sirius 3. We have all been waiting anxiously for your party to arrive, because we understood that once you reach the Hotel Olympia, all of us who have been waiting a long time can begin, as it seems to be so. But in addition, I am glad to become known to you and have you know me, in that I, for my part, will search out and locate the coral-encrusted objects, which will then be brought out of Mare Nostrum and brought to you at your shop.
I am the engineer in charge of discrete artifacts and the transporting thereof on Mr. Nurbkoldak's request to your shop. A quasi-arachnid, brightly black in its chitinous exoskeleton, said.
You haven't done any preliminary work? Molly asked. While you waited?
Glimmong kept us in our rooms, the bivalve explained. We did 2 things. 1, we read all pertinent documents relating to the history of Heldskala. 2, we watched on a video monitor as robot sensors scanned the sunken cathedral time and again. On our screens we have seen Heldskala countless times, but now we will be allowed to touch it.
I wish I could go to sleep, Molly said.
She rested her close-cropped head on Joe's shoulder and slumped against him.
Wake me up when we get there.
The quasi-arachnid said to Joe and the bivalve, This total undertaking, it reminds me of an Earth saga, parts of which we were required to memorize during our educational years. It made a deep impression on me.
He means the Faust theme, the bivalve told Joe. Faustian man, striving upward, never satisfied. Glimmong is like Faust in certain respects, unlike him in others.
Rustling its antennae in agitation, the quasi-arachnid said,
Glimmong resembles Faust in all respects. The Faust, at least, of Goethe, which is the version I adhere to.
Eerie, Joe thought. A chitinous multi-legged quasi-arachnid and a large bivalve with pseudopodia arguing about Goethe's Faust. A book which I've never read, and it originated on my planet, is the product of a human being.
Part of the difficulty, the quasi-arachnid was saying,
lies in the translation. It was written in a language which has died out.
German, Joe said. He knew that much, at least.
I have, the quasi-arachnid muttered, made a...
It groped in a plastic utility pouch slung over its shoulder. Four of its manual extremities busily sorted through the pouch.
Damn thing, it muttered. Everything sinks to the bottom. Here it is.
It brought out a much-folded sheet of paper, which it proceeded to unfold carefully.
I have made my own translation into modern-day Terran, formerly called English. I will read you the crucial scene from the second part, the moment at last when Faust pauses in contemplation of what he has done and is content. Whatever the expression is. All right, Mr. Fernwright, sir?
Sure, Joe said, as the truck rumbled along, over potholes and rocks, shaking and swaying the creatures within it. Molly now seemed to have totally fallen asleep. She had certainly been right about the driving skill of the Wourge. The truck rattled through the darkness at a great rate.
A swamp surrounds the mountains, the quasi-arachnid read from its carefully preserved sheet of paper. Poisoning everything already reclaimed. To drain the foul marsh, this must be done. This would be the highest conquest possible. I'll open room for many millions. Not in any sense safe, but daily freed in which to live. Green the meadow and fruitful. Men and herds almost already on the most new earth, settled on the rim of which has been pushed up by bold people's efforts. Here within a paradise land that keeps outside the flood, and as it eats away, tries to enter and take over, a group will hurries to cut it off. Yes, this...
The bivalve interrupted the quasi-arachnid's earnest recitation.
Your translation is not idiomatic. Men and herds almost already on the most new earth. Grammatically it is correct, but no Terran talks like that.
The bivalve waved a pseudo-podium toward Joe, seeking his support.
Isn't that so, Mr. Fernwright?
Joe thought, men and herds almost already on the most new earth. The bivalve was right, of course, but...
I like it, Joe said.
Highly pleased, the quasi-arachnid yelped,
and see how much it resembles us and the Glimmung, the Undertaking. Within here, a paradise land that keeps outside the flood. The flood is a symbol for everything that eats away structures which living creatures have erected. The water which has covered Heldskala. The flood won out many centuries ago, but now Glimmung is going to push it back. A group will, which hurries to cut it off. That is all of us. Perhaps Goethe was a precog. Perhaps he foresaw the raising of Heldskala.
The truck slowed.
We're there, the Wourge driver informed them.
He applied his brakes, and the truck came to a squeaking halt, causing everyone aboard to pitch violently. Molly stirred, opened her eyes. She glanced around in each direction, panic shaping her face. Obviously, she could not orient herself immediately.
We're there, Joe said to her, and hugged her against him.
And now it begins, he reflected. For better or worse, for richer, for poorer, until... Death, he thought. Do us part. Odd that he should think of that, the litany of the marriage vows. Yet it seemed to fit. Death in some indistinct form seemed to hover close by. Stiffly, he rose, helped Molly up. They and the others began creakily to get down from the back of the truck. The night air, with its smell of the sea, he took a deep breath. It is really close now, he realized. The sea, the cathedral. And Glimmung, trying to separate them, the sea pushed back from Heldskala. Like God did, he thought. Separating the dark from the light, or however it goes, and the water from the land. To the quasi-arachnid, he said, God, in Genesis, was very Faustian. Molly moaned.
Good Lord, theology in the middle of the night.
In the damp, cold air, she shivered, peering around her.
I don't see a damn thing. We're in the center of no place.
Against the dim nocturnal sky, Joe made out what appeared to be a geodesic dome. There it is, he said to himself. The other trucks had arrived by now. All had stopped, and from each of them the throng of life forms emerged, each in its own peculiar fashion. Some helped others. The reddish jelly, for example, had a difficult time until a spiny apparition resembling a hostile bowling ball helped it down. A hovercraft, illuminated and large, manifested itself above them, gradually descending until at last it had parked itself in the midst of their group.
Hello, it said. I am your conveyance to your work areas.
Board me carefully, and I will take you there if you would, please. Hello, hello.
Hello to you, too, Joe said to himself as he and the rest of them slithered, flapped, and bumbled aboard. Inside the geodesic dome, they were met by a horde of robots. Joe stared in disbelief. Robots?
They're not illegal here, Molly pointed out. You must get it into your mind. You're not on Earth anymore.
Joe said, but Edgar Mahan proved that a synthetic life form can't come into existence. Life has to come from life, and therefore, in the construction of self-programming mechanisms...
Well, you're looking at 20 of them, Molly said.
Why were we told they couldn't be made? Joe asked her.
Because there are too many unemployed people on Earth as it is. The government faked scientific evidence and documentation to say robots couldn't be done. They are rare, however. They are hard to build and costly. I'm surprised to see this many. It is all he has, I'm sure. This is a...
She searched for the word.
For our benefit, a display, to impress us.
One of the robots, catching sight of Joe, coasted directly toward him.
Mr. Fernwright?
Yes, Joe said. He looked around him at the corridors and massive doors and the recessed overhead lighting. Efficient, extensive, and labyrinthine. And without defect. Obviously, it had just been built, and not yet put to use.
I'm amazingly glad to see you, the robot declared. In the center of my chest, you will probably see the word Willis stenciled. I am programmed to respond to any instruction beginning with that word. For example, if you would like to see your work area, merely say, Willis, I would like to be taken to my work area. And I would then happily lead you there, giving pleasure to myself and hopefully to you as well.
Willis, Joe said, are there living quarters here for us? For example, is there a private room for Miss Yoyez? She's tired. She should be asleep.
A three-room apartment is ready for you and Miss Yoyez, Willis said. Your personal living quarters.
What? Joe said.
A three-room apartment? You mean we have an actual apartment, not just a room?
A three-room apartment, Willis repeated with robotic patience.
Take us there, Joe said.
No, Willis said. You have to say, Willis, take us there.
Willis, take us there.
Yes, Mr. Fernwright. The robot led them across the foyer to the elevators. After looking over the apartment, Joe got Molly into bed. She fell asleep without a sound. Even the bed was large. Everything in the apartment was solid and in good taste, of a modest sort, and the apartment itself was, like its contents, large. He could hardly believe it. He examined the kitchen, the living room, and found, in the living room, on a coffee table, a jar from Held Scala. As soon as he saw it, he knew what it was. Seating himself on the couch, he reached out and carefully picked it up. The deep yellow glaze. He had never seen such a rich yellow before. It surpassed even the yellows of Delft tiles, surpassed, in fact, Royal Albert yellow. That made him wonder about bone china. Are there bone beds here? He asked himself. And if so, what percentage bone are they using? 60%? 40? And are there bone beds as good as the people's bone bed in Moravia? Willis, he said.
Yes, sir.
Questioningly, Joe said,
yes, sir. Why not yes, sir?
The robot said,
I just done been reading Earth history, Master Fernwright, sir.
Are there bone beds here on Plowman's planet?
Well, Master Fernwright, I don't rightly know. I guess that y'all can ask the central computator if...
I order you to talk correctly, Joe said.
Y'all gotta say Willis first. If y'all want me to...
Willis, talk correctly.
Yes, Mr. Fernwright.
Willis, can you take me to my work area?
Yes, Mr. Fernwright.
Okay, Joe said. Take me there. The robot unlocked a heavy steel and asbestos door and stood to one side, permitting Joe Fernwright to enter the enormous dark room. Overhead lights came on automatically as he crossed the threshold. He saw, at the far end of the room, a major workbench, and fully equipped. Three sets of Waldos, glare-free lighting which operated from a pedal console, self-focusing magnifying glasses 15 inches and more in diameter. The separate heat needles, all the known sizes. To the left of the workbench he saw protective cartons, a kind which he had read about but never seen. Going over, He picked one up, dropped it experimentally, and watched it float downward, gently landing, without impact. And the sealed containers of glazes. Every tint, shade, and hue was represented. The row of containers lined one side of the room in four rows. With them, he could match virtually the glazes of every pot coming onto his bench. One more item. He walked over to it and inspected it with wonder. A weightless area where gravity was balanced by a ring of invisible counterspin. This was the ultimate workshop device for a pot healer, this weightless area. He would not need to secure the pieces of pot in order to meld them together. The pieces in the weightless chamber would simply remain where he put them. By means of this, he could handle four times the number of pots he had turned out in former times. And those were times of prosperity. And the positioning would be absolutely exact. Nothing would slip, slide, or tilt during the healing process. He noted, too, the kiln, which might be needed if a shard were missing and the need to create a duplicate came into being. Thus, he could complete pots of which he did not have all the pieces. This aspect of the craft of pot healing was not generally dealt with publicly, but it existed. Never in his life had he seen such a well-equipped shop for pot healing. Already, a number of broken pots had been brought in. A pile of filled protective cartons had accumulated at the incoming end of the bench. I could start right now, he realized. All I have to do is flip a half dozen switches and I'm in business. Tempting. He walked over to the rack of heat needles, took one down, held it. Well balanced, he decided. Quality product, the best. He opened one of the filled cartons, gazed down at the potsherds. His interest became emergent instantly. Setting down the heat needle, he took the shards out one by one, enjoying the glazes and the glazed texture of the pot. A short, fat pot. A funny pot, perhaps. He put the pieces back in the carton and turned, with the idea of carrying them over to the weightless area. He wanted to begin. This was his life. Never did I think, he thought, that I would have access to, the use of... He halted, and felt inside as if some animal had gnawed at his heart. Gnawed it with greed. And delight. A black figure, like a negative of life itself, stood facing him. It had been watching him, and now that he faced it, he thought it would go away. But it remained. He waited a little longer. It still remained. What is this thing? He asked the robot, who still stood at the threshold of the workroom. You have to say Willis first, the robot reminded him. You have to say, Willis, what... Willis, he said, what is it? A calend, the robot said.